Missouri Democratic Congressman Emanuel Cleaver calls the deal a sugar-coated Satan sandwich. Wait, let me try that again. A sugar-coated Satan sandwich because it doesn't protect the poor. Arizona Senator John McCain said he'd swallow hard and vote for it, even though he's worried about cuts in defense spending. Arms that haven't already been broken are still being twisted to get passage of that 11th-hour deal to raise the debt ceiling by more than $2 trillion and cut about the same amount of government spending by tomorrow. Let's see where we are. Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, perhaps others listening also had their extreme makeover home edition interrupted last night when the president briefly announced that the deal had been struck. You were there. What was the mood last night? What's the mood today?
We saw something last night that I suddenly realized I haven't seen up here in many weeks, and that is relief and expressions of what actually looked like a smile on faces and friendship. I mean, the tension leading up to this was unlike anything I've seen here short of 9/11 and war. Mm. I mean, this was the enormous stakes, both political, you know, for the future of the president, the future of the speaker, economic. You know, there's not a household in America that wouldn't have been affected by a default, and seriously so. And also a real sense, is Congress so deeply dysfunctional that it can't do anything anymore? This was a narrative that you just couldn't miss.
Well, some people are still saying that despite the deal, because it still isn't inked. So, first of all, what shifted to get it done last night? What happened?
Well, to put it bluntly, the Senate has some very experienced old foxes, not age but experience. And in the end, that experience kicked in. Mitch McConnell, who I think came up with some of the more astonishing initiatives here, including something no one had ever heard of before, a face-saving gesture that allows the debt ceiling to pass with only 34 senators having to vote for it. It's called a resolution of disapproval, and no one can find any precedent for it in past Senate history. And in the final hours on Saturday, it turns out that he set up private talks with the vice president, and the two of them really moved this deal along to the point at which others could join. So it's this sort of wait till the last minute, don't get out in front of the cameras, don't burn too many bridges, and just let experience kick in. That's, I think, the key to this deal.
Well, were there some trades, though? I mean, we were hearing the thinking that the Democrats were holding out for some, again, face-saving cuts in defense spending because they weren't getting any revenue increases. It seemed as if finally, you know, Sunday talk shows and even some of the, you know, the Democrats themselves seemed to be able to articulate that side of the narrative that they had nothing in this deal. No loopholes closed, no tax breaks for the rich thrown out, nothing but spending cuts. So did they get something in the 11th hour?
They did. That's part of the experience in this bill. You now have two parts, an initial hike of the debt ceiling with spending cuts greater than that hike. That was the Republicans' key demand. And then you have something else, that everyone can see something in this new joint legislative committee that they have wanted to see.
And this, again, and if you can jump in to say, and this is the committee that the president announced that will take up further issues down the road.
Exactly. They have to come up with 1.2 to 1.5 trillion additional deficit saving measures, but it's not entirely clear how they'll do it. Revenue could be a part of this. Tax reform could be a part of it. There's a trigger mechanism. If, in fact, this committee doesn't come up with a package that Congress can pass to make sure that deficit reduction occurs, there is an automatic set of spending cuts that kick in, half of them domestic spending, half of them defense spending. So Democrats can look at that and go, ah, we didn't get the revenue we wanted. We didn't get those tax breaks in the first round, but the committee can come up with that. The committee can cut deep into defense. In fact, the trigger mandates that half of the cuts be defense.
Well, I'm going to jump in and ask, though, what makes people think that the same Tea Party-backed legislators, the freshman legislators that wouldn't let that happen now, will let that happen then?
Well, that is, of course, a wonderful question. I would say, first by corrective, that when you look at the vote counts here, it isn't the freshmen that are the heart of it. They are kind of the poster children for the new conservative face to the House. But it's actually the people that have been there longer. Michelle Bachmann, Ron Paul, they've been here to Jim Jordan of Ohio, been here 2-3 years, that are, I would say, the muscle behind what the conservatives have demanded here. But, you know, the point you raise is true for absolutely anything Congress does. The fact is, one Congress cannot bind another, no matter how good it looks on paper. So even though you project 10 years of cuts, who's to say that the American people have an entirely different view on where the country should be going in the 2012 elections and send back a very different Congress? They take one look at all of this and say, I don't think so, and undo it.
Well, meanwhile, some other things that aren't in the deal, there's no balanced budget amendment, which some on the right wanted. There are no cuts to benefits such as Medicare or Social Security. That's also going to be taken up by this special congressional committee. But you say it's not sure what's going to happen with the tax reform. The president said last night it's going to happen. We're hearing today Republicans are saying they won't allow it. And we're hearing Democrats like Dick Durbin express concern if they don't. Let's listen.
I hope we can have an emerging national consensus. The debt is a problem, but getting America back to work is the first challenge. I'm not sure that this approach of cutting spending, as you mentioned earlier with your last guest, is the best way to put people back to work. But we have to deal with it because of the economic realities in the House of Representatives.
That's Dick Durbin on CNN, and obviously somebody else had talked about cutting spending. And here's a Democrat saying, wait a minute, you know, we're not sure about that. Gail Chadwick, will Democrats hold this vote up today?
I wouldn't say they'd hold it up. I would say they are a real factor and much more than anyone expected. I'm hearing a lot from liberal Democrats and even some of the moderates who fear that, you know, it didn't go far enough, that the rating agencies said that we will downgrade U.S. AAA rating under two conditions. One, that they don't raise the debt ceiling in time to avoid default. And two, and this is a critical piece, that they don't deal with the underlying unsustainability of the current fiscal situation.
Right.
And that's what people like Mark Warner had proposed, $4 trillion in cuts, $5 trillion, $6 trillion in deficit reduction, including revenues. And this doesn't come close to that.
Well, meanwhile, many Tea Partiers, Tea Party-backed legislators are celebrating. They're saying, listen, we're not getting tax increases. We're cutting spending at a greater rate than we're raising the debt ceiling. To me, this is what we set out to do. This is Alan Kinzinger, a freshman Tea Party-backed congressman from Illinois. So, you know, Gail, I suppose the debate over who won goes on, but what's your sense of what happens next? Just quickly tell us the vote.
I think it passes, but with tremendous debts back and forth, you know, as you said, wrenching of arms and promises. What's interesting about this and not previous efforts is that you can't buy votes. I mean, there is not a huge cache of money to add to spending. Usually a deal like this, you end up promising things to everyone. You can't do that.
Nothing left. The pantry is bare.
The pantry is very bare.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
So what are the economic ramifications? Let's turn to Binyamin Applebaum, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Binyamin, we just heard some conservative Republicans saying it doesn't cut enough, Democrats saying it doesn't do anything to raise revenue. What are economists saying?
Economists are saying that it's likely to be bad for the economy, at least in the short term. You know, we already are growing much more slowly than we had understood. We're sort of right on the precipice, frankly, between growing and not growing. And if the government is spending less money, investing less money in the economy, that means that there's less economic activity. Right now, it's not clear we can afford that.
To be clear, this isn't just economists on the left, Robert Reich, Paul Krugman. This is a wide swath of economists saying that cutting spending at a time of a fragile economy is not a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you polled 100 economists from across the spectrum, what you would have heard very clearly is that the federal debt is a problem and it needs to be dealt with, but it is a long-term problem and it doesn't need to be dealt with right now. And indeed, any program of cuts should wait until the economy is stronger. I think you would have been hard-pressed to find more than a handful of economists of any political persuasion who think it's a good idea to start making cuts in the fall of 2011.
I suppose how we came to this is the conversation we've been having all along. But now what? What about the U.S. credit rating? This plan has over $2 trillion in cuts, but Standard & Poor's have said they wanted at least $4 trillion. Obviously, they don't buy into that spending argument. But people like Krugman and Reich have said, why should we listen to them? They're the ratings agencies that got us into the housing collapse, for instance. So, you know, throwing that all into the mix, is it likely that they might still lower the credit rating from, say, AAA to AA, even though the debt ceiling looks like it's going to be raised?
The terms of this deal do not meet the criteria that Standard & Poor's has articulated for the American government to retain its highest credit rating, its risk-free credit rating. And so it's now a political question about whether Standard & Poor's has the nerve to downgrade the federal government. There's a couple things to say about it. The first is that, you know, the ratings agencies do have a credibility problem. They're not the brightest people in the room. Their record is abysmal. But if they're doing their jobs well, what they're doing is reflecting market sentiment. And so the question really is, do bond investors have less faith in the American government than they used to? And that's an open question right now. We'll see some indication in the movement of the price of federal debt in the coming days. The other thing to say is that the bond agencies are not exactly participating in the debate about what's best for America. That's not their primary concern. Their primary concern is what is best for investors. And just as with companies, we can see a difference between what the owners of a company like and think is right and what the bank thinks is right for that company, so too with the question of how America should be managed. There can be a real distinction with what Standard & Poor's thinks is best for the United States of America, and what is best in the minds of the American people.
Benjamin Applebaum, we're going to stay with you after the break, but just briefly before we go into that break in about a minute and a half. So we're waiting to hear about the credit rating, but in the short term, we know there are going to be cuts extended over 10 years. We're going to be hearing about a city that declared bankruptcy today. Just give us a thumbnail. Again, we're going to go into a break, but what impact might these cuts have? How might they reverberate out?
Well, the cuts are, in the first phase this fall, about $20 to $25 billion. It's relatively modest, and a lot of it will come out of programs that allocate money to states and cities. So you'll see a rippling effect all through the economy. Most of it is delayed into the later years, 2013 and onwards, and that's when you would really start to see a hit in the amount of money that the government sends to states, cities, and to less fortunate Americans.
Well, Benjamin Applebaum, again, of the New York Times. And Benjamin, I just want to be clear, because you say in your article today that most economists across the board agree that this idea of these spending cuts should have been held off for at least a year, maybe more, because the economy is so fragile. But you're not saying that most economists don't agree that there is waste in the debt.
To the contrary, there's almost an equally broad consensus in the economics profession that the scale of the federal debt has become unmanageable, that a nation cannot afford to carry such a large debt going forward without serious economic consequences, without a real sort of debilitating impact on the economy. That's because if the government is borrowing, private businesses can't get access to that same money. If the government is spending, it may not be as efficient at spending as private actors. And just the sheer scale of the interest payments every year, $250 billion a year roughly, is a big chunk of economic activity. So there is an absolute consensus that the government needs to pay down its debts. There's no question about that. But the question is when and how. And that's where you see concerns about the timing and the nature of this deal.
Well, and Mohamed Elberian, head of the investing fund PIMCO, says that unemployment is going to be higher, growth will be lower, inequality will be worse because the cuts are coming now.
Yeah, that's not a very cheerful list, is it?
No.
We're already in a situation where growth, as I said, is happening at about the same rate. The growth of the economy is about the same as the growth of the population, which is to say we're not getting any richer. And any sort of removal of economic activity from that baseline starts to look an awful lot like a danger of a renewed recession.
And Benjamin,
there's a lot of concern.
Just a couple seconds, literally. Do you have any faith that the plan to maybe get rid of some tax breaks for the wealthy and get some revenue down the road will happen in this political climate?
You know, interesting thing about that, this deal came to pass because Republicans refused to compromise and they were in the driver's seat. Next fall, the Bush tax cuts are set to expire. It's Democrats who are in the driver's seat. We could well see a grand bargain, as it were, without anyone making any compromise.
We'll check with you then. Benjamin, thank you.
Thank you.